Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, Northern Europe's long winter leaves migrating storks shivering in Poland.
Pierwszy raz spotkaliśmy się właśnie.
This is the first time the storks have been here when it was so cold. The weather has been unpredictable. Spring is very late. There's a lot of snow.
We visit Europe's first wave-powered electricity plant in Spain's Bay of Biscay.
The renewable sector hopes to create more than 200,000 green jobs in Spain this year and 3 million across Europe.
And tourists tear through the dunes and mudflats of Jordan's Wadi Rum desert.
Travelling in motorcades of up to 5 cars at a time, these oversized vehicles churn through the sand and mud, making deep tracks and plenty of noise.
I'm Louisa Schaefer, standing in for Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. It's been a long, hard winter in Northern Europe. Grey, wet, windy. One local paper here in Germany, the Tagesspiegel, has called it the 100-year winter. Just over the border in Poland, migrating birds are returning from Africa to build their nests, only to find their feeding and breeding grounds smothered in snow. Now the stork is revered in Poland, considered a symbol of happiness and good luck. The idea of the birds freezing or starving to death has motivated people across the country to organize emergency feed programs. We have this news report from the Associated Press.
The very long winter that continues to grip much of Northern Europe has left migrating storks shivering and struggling to find food in Poland. The storks normally eat insects, frogs, fish, rodents, and reptiles, but with so much snow still on the ground, this year the pickings have been slim. Elspieta Tarasinska is the president of Lubelski Animals, an animal protection organization in the Polish town of Lublin. Today, she and her team of volunteers are scattering chunks of fresh meat on the snow for the storks to eat.
This is the first time the storks have been here when it was so cold. The weather has been unpredictable. Spring is very late. There's a lot of snow. I don't remember a time when there was so much snow.
The European white stork is Poland's national bird. The storks migrate back to Poland every spring after spending the winter on the savannas between Kenya and South Africa. About 50,000 pairs of storks nest in Poland each year. That accounts for about a fifth of the world's white stork population. The weather in this part of Europe was quite mild a few months ago, but Poland has since been plunged into darkness and cold with record low temperatures. The arrival of the storks has animal protection volunteer Dominika Czubaj-Gisewska very worried.
We're bringing food that would look like a moving frog to a stork. They eat hearts, livers, and stomachs.
Stork protection groups have been hard at work across the country. A nesting stork is considered a lucky sign, and people encourage the birds by raising platforms in high places for them to build on. Storks favour high trees, rooftops, telegraph poles and pylons to build their huge nests. The volunteers here in Lublin are hoping that spring will arrive before the migrating storks starve or freeze.
A report there from the Associated Press. We leave the snowdrifts of Poland now and head to a desert in the Middle East. Jordan's Wadi Rum is famous in the West as the location for the filming of the 1962 hit Lawrence of Arabia. Since then, the desert has become a destination for rock climbers, hand gliders, and scores of tourists. Desert expedition programs have been set up to accommodate them, including multi-day trips by jeep to see old ruins and sandstone mountains. Wadi Rum is now filled with 4x4s that tear through the harsh terrain. And while the visitors bring business to the region, environmentalists are worried about permanent damage. Vanessa O'Brien has more.
In the blistering sun of Jordan's Wadi Rum Desert, you almost expect to see Lawrence of Arabia, or at least his ghost, with Arab garb flowing in the wind, nobly astride a camel. After all, the famous film Lawrence of Arabia is what made this vast 74,000-hectare desert in Jordan so famous. The 1962 film was filmed right here on Wadi Rum's Red and Gold Sands, where the real T.E. Lawrence stationed his troops during the Arab revolts of 1917 and 1918. Fast forward almost a century and the landscape is essentially the same. Sweeping sands form a valley cut into towering mountains of sandstone and granite rock. But there's a new intruder here, four-wheel drive tour groups. Travelling in motorcades of up to five cars at a time, these oversized vehicles churn through the sand and mud, making deep tracks and plenty of noise.
Our major problem with the travel agency if they didn't understand Wadi Rum, because we have a huge number who use the cars.
That's Wadi Rum director Nasser Al-Zawadeh. He's a local Bedouin, born and raised in Wadi Rum.
Just between the village and the nearest site, more than 100 of road. If you see it, it's like lions in the desert.
The most recent figures show more than 250,000 tourists come to Wadi Rum each year. Numbers have taken a hit since the Arab Spring in the region, but they're expected to rise again in the future on the back of the site's UNESCO World Heritage status, which it was granted in 2011. Due to the remoteness of the desert's location, most of these tourists have just a two-hour window to experience the unique rock formations and desert landscapes of Wadi Rum, so they choose a four-wheel drive rather than a camel to see as much as they can. Some 1,000 four-wheel drives are available for hire in the area, says Al-Zawadeh.
To be honest, we haven't a plan to reduce the number of the visitors. And if we have a visitors, we study the carrying capacity, how we can distribute the visitors, how we can confess the visitor to use camels rather than the cars.
That's the taste that you have. No
pressure.
And it has an amber. Cardamom. Cardamom. It has also some cinnamon in it. Cinnamon.
Oh, yeah.
Cinnamon. That's the tea that you're drinking.
Recently, the Aqaba Special Economic Zone Authority, which is responsible for Wadi Rum, has started a new conservation plan for the desert. They have made 250,000 Jordanian dinars available, that's around $350,000, to make it happen. The main focus of the new plan is to make the current split of Wadi Rum into an intensive use area of 200 square kilometres and a wilderness zone of more than 500 square kilometres more official. The intensive use area will now be exclusively for the Bedouin tourist camps and four-wheel drive activity, while the wilderness zone is reserved for those hiking on foot or riding a camel or horse. As part of the plans, a single road will be gravelled for four-wheel drive use in order to prevent vehicles destroying more than 360 species of rare flora and fauna on makeshift tracks. Development within the intensive use zone will be regulated to protect the interests of local Bedouin who depend on tourism, and waste will be managed in a more sustainable manner to cope with increasing tourism numbers. Here's Al-Zawadeh once more.
We have a lot of meeting with UNESCO in Amman. They have a condition, because if you want Wadi Rum to be not in danger, you should work, because we have a great challenge to change an image of Wadi Rum from the activity in the past and the new activity, which should be environmental friendly. This is a huge job for us, for me and for my team also, but we are working in that.
Animal life too is benefiting from the new environmental focus. This hungry Arabian oryx calf is a welcome sound in Wadi Rum these days, after the oryx was hunted to extinction here 80 years ago. Three years back, the Environment Agency of Abu Dhabi sponsored a $1.1 million project to reintroduce the oryx to Wadi Rum. Eight male and 12 female oryx were brought to a protected enclosure in Wadi Rum. It's been a huge success. Today there are more than 60 oryx, and it's hoped that the first will be released back into the wild this year. Local Bedouin ranger Ish Ali Al-Zalabia says reintroducing the oryx to Wadi Rum and protecting the desert environment is essential in order to pass it on to future generations.
Wadi Rum, it's the most beautiful places around the world, and you can feel the silence and the nature. It's a simple place. It's nature, not like the other places, Petra or Jarash or the other places. It's human-made, but Wadi Rum, it's natural. So I like it as a natural place.
It's amber,
right.
Amber, originally it's from a gland from a whale.
Right.
But for the moment, the tourists just keep on coming. For that reason, Friends of Earth Middle East director Munkith Meyer says that officials and desert caretakers need to remain vigilant.
Our sites are delicate, from Wadi Rum to Petra to Dead Sea and so on. So we always like to think of the carrying capacity of the site to be studied well before you open the door wide open to tourism. So I would like to see a study what the ecosystem can handle per day of tourists to go through it and come back.
Whether such a study will occur in the next few years remains uncertain. One thing is for sure, conservation efforts in Wadi Rum are slowly improving. Vanessa O'Brien, DW, Jordan.
Music there from Jordanian-Palestinian music star Diana Karazon. We turn now to the issue of food waste. In Europe and North America, people throw out about 100 kilograms of perfectly good food each year. That's a huge amount of food just landing in the trash. Well, we're about to meet someone who was so shocked by those numbers that he decided to take action. Valentin Tourne has made a film about what happens to the food we toss out. He's also set up a website to encourage people to swap food that they're not able to eat. In Valentin's hometown of Cologne, the idea is catching on, and our correspondent Emma Wallace went along to find out how it works.
The overall amount of food waste that goes to the bins is almost or even more than half of what we grow for humans. It is estimated that every fifth bag we are purchasing is going directly to the bins. I mean, it doesn't go directly because usually it spends some time in our fridges, but we could have been consuming it before we bought too much. And this is actually the reason why we created food sharing, because all of us, we are the victims of this system of overconsumption. And what we wanted to do with food sharing is give people an opportunity to say, okay, I really value food. I don't want to throw it away. If I don't have a friend or family nearby, I really offer it to somebody in the neighborhood for free, as it usually has been done in the villages, one or two generations ago. This was just usual. Now it's gone. And we want to revitalize this habit.
At her house across town in Cologne, with her daughter playing piano in the background, Marion Kulina was inspired by Valentin's idea and how the first thing he shared was some leftover apples from his allotment. She enthusiastically logged on, and so the seeds grew.
When I heard this, I remembered the apple tree of the Garden Eden. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this apple tree and this apple tree, and I thought, this will change the world again. So that impressed me so much. So I decided to be a member of this group, and I asked them to accept me.
The website works very well in Marion's household.
I have three children, and when the older boys lived with us, it was not necessary to share because everything is eaten. Most packages are made for four people. And now we are only three people, and every time something is left over.
Hallo, wer ist da?
Hallo, hier ist Friederike von Foodsharing.
Alles klar, komm rauf.
Marion has posted on the food sharing site, and today a couple of these younger members of the community have come to pick up her bounty.
Hallo zusammen.
As they chat about the site, one of them tells Marion this is the third time they've picked things up via the site. They think many of the sharers are like them in their mid-20s.
I read about this site when it was still relatively new, and I remember thinking, what a cool idea. There are often things in my fridge that are just left over and sitting there. I don't know what to do with it. You know you're not going to eat it, but I hate to just throw it away. No one has a good feeling when they throw food away.
As well as not wasting food, this is all about community. In addition to the tins that she posted, Marion throws in a jar of plum jam as a present. She's looking forward to the summer when she can join other food sharing initiatives.
One reason for sharing food is because I do have a garden, and in summer I have lots of vegetables. I like to put it in the basket in summer, so I'm waiting for this time. And there is an initiative to make marmalade from this fruit and in summer. So I'm very interested in being part of this initiative.
This is one of the food sharing hotspots though, Marion.
Yeah.
And it's dark and it's cold and it's an open space with a lot of mud.
Yeah.
We leave the tins and Marion assures me that it's not always this quiet. And it does seem to be working, as Valentin Thorn explains. They have plans to go global.
For the moment, you can only use the database of the cities in Germany, but there have been so many requests from a lot of other countries. I mean, especially countries in crisis, I have to say. Argentinians are very keen to bring this to Argentina. So what we did was first a small video to explain it in Spanish language, and now we're going to translate it. So, and I don't want to have centralized solutions. This is a platform for local solutions. So in every place you have different ideas. For instance, the hotspot where food is being distributed here in Cologne is in an urban gardening situation. In Berlin, it's inside a market hall, and in a small city called Rheine, in a very conservative gardening association inside the bar of this association. So, I mean, every place has different solutions.
Thank you to Emma Wallace for that report. If you want to find out more about the project, go to foodsharing.de. Across the European Union, governments are making a concerted effort to reduce the use of fossil fuel. Countries like Norway are turning to hydroelectric power. Others, like Portugal, Denmark, and Germany, have created financial incentives to support the growth of wind and solar energy. But Spanish engineers have found a way to harness the power of waves to produce electricity. In this next report, correspondent Lauren Freyer takes us into the heart of Europe's first wave energy plant.
Waves constantly thrash the tiny fishing village of Mutricu on Spain's north coast. Tax logs from the 13th century describe dangerous surf and shipwrecks here. Water used to hurl debris through windows of homes before the local government built a cement breakwater a few years ago to shelter the harbor. Now residents can stroll down a pier and out over the breakwater, which is hollow. And hidden inside, Spanish scientists like Gloria Echevarria are busy generating electricity from these powerful waves that roll in off the Bay of Biscay.
The government decided to build a breakwater to protect the harbor of Mutricu. And so, making use of that decision, we decided to put there our wave energy plant.
Echevarria is a renewable energy technician who specializes in marine power. It's electricity generated from tides or waves. It's a relatively young industry that Spain is exploring after investing heavily in solar and wind power for decades. Echevarria guides me inside Mutriku's breakwater, a hollow cement and stone structure more than 4 football fields long. Inside are 16 turbines spinning with each wave that rolls in. They use technology called OWC, oscillating water columns. Echevarria explains.
We have some chambers, and when the wave arrives, the wave pushes, compresses the air inside the chambers. So the air goes through a turbine and drives it, that in turn drives an alternator, so producing electricity.
Salt water would corrode the turbines pretty quickly and require expensive repairs, but the water doesn't touch them. It's only air pushed by the waves underneath. The Mutriku plant connected its turbines to Spain's power grid 2 summers ago, making it Europe's first commercial wave plant. Since then, similar technology has been used in Scotland and the Azores. The plant cost the regional government about 2 million euros to build, beyond the cost of the breakwater, which was going to be built anyway. It has a capacity of about 300 kilowatts, supplying constant power to about 600 residents. Now, that's very small compared to Spain's wind and solar capacity, which on sunny, windy days can generate up to 70% of the country's electricity. But just like Spain's construction bubble, there's been a renewable energy bubble here too, which popped when Spanish lawmakers slashed the budget last year, says Gonzalo Escribano, an energy economist at Madrid's Elcano Royal Institute.
Because we got a bubble, mainly in the solar power. What they said is, now we got a moratoria. What does it mean, moratoria? Moratoria means no new installation will receive support. That's it.
In the boom years, the government offered generous subsidies for renewable energy. Now those are gone. So big, expensive solar plants aren't as attractive as small-scale experimental projects, like the Mutriku wave plant. Ironically, the economic crisis could mean a blossoming of different types of renewable energy, now that subsidies for wind or solar are gone, Escribano says.
You got a lot of energy sources, and you will need all of them. You will need conventional, you will need new energies, and the more you got from anything, the best, you know. So you have to pursue all the paths. Perhaps in some ways, in some technologies, your path is leading nowhere, but you will never know until you're there.
It took Spain's wind energy industry about 30 years to get close to being competitive with natural gas, so it could be decades before we know how successful wave power might be here. But Spain is desperately searching for an industry to replace all the jobs lost when the construction sector collapsed. Unemployment tops 26%. Juan Goicolea is the Vice Minister of Innovation and Technology for the Basque Regional Government, which oversees the Mutriku wave plant.
Construction is a low capital intensive, high number of jobs. Renewable energy is capital intensive. But in the end, it creates added value that will be recycled through other activities that will create jobs.
The renewable sector hopes to create more than 200,000 green jobs in Spain this year and 3 million across Europe. That won't make up for Spain's lost construction jobs, but it's a start. Back at the Mutriku wave plant, the technician Echevarria says the lean economy can sometimes force scientists to get creative. Government subsidies used to create incentives, but now the field is wide open.
So we are looking for new ways of doing something.
Lauren Freyer, DW, Mutriku, Spain.
Our next report takes us to meet a group of mountain gorillas living on the volcanic slopes of Uganda. These gorillas live in communities of up to 30 individuals. There is usually one dominant older adult male that leads the group, often called a silverback because of the silver hair found in his otherwise dark fur. These 400-pound animals are usually depicted beating their chests and roaring. But actually, mountain gorillas are gentle, intelligent, and highly social, even when they meet tourists in the jungle. Our reporter, Brigitte Osterrat in Uganda, trekked with a group into the mountains and has this report. The English version is read by Gabriel Borud.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
My name is Gad. I'm one of the guides here, and I'll be leading some of you, the gorillas today.
Two dozen tourists are gathered at the edge of the Bwindi Impenetrable National Park in southwestern Uganda, where about 300 of the total 800 mountain gorillas live. For about 400 euros, or 500 US dollars, tourists can participate in a gorilla tracking trip into the forest. God, our guide, divides everyone into groups. Everyone is getting excited. They don't really know what to expect.
Okay. Any question? No questions. Who wants to do the gorillas?
With God in the lead, our group follows a narrow path winding up the mountain. We climb a good 400 meters. Mountain gorillas are only present in Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Zoologist Martha Robbins is a researcher with the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. She has studied the great apes for 25 years.
Remarkably, mountain gorillas are one of the few types of apes that we know that has been increasing in the past few decades due to the immense conservation efforts to protect them.
It's quite easy to count gorillas that have become accustomed to humans. The gorillas that lead a more remote life are harder to study. For this, research teams move out in a net across the national park. They gather scat from the animals' nests where they sleep in order to extract and analyze DNA. This is one of the best ways to find out how many different individuals live in the forest. An hour and a half of walking up the mountain has brought God and his tourists to an elevation of 1,800 meters, or around 6,000 feet. We push through the thick brush. After another hour, God tells us that three more guides are joining our group.
Is everybody fine?
Yeah.
These are the staff trackers who came to look for the gorillas. These three guys. Okay. So they have seen the gorillas already. Mm-hmm. You are being requested to pull out your cameras. Then they take us to the gorillas.
But the gorillas are curious. They've already spotted the tourists and are closing in for a better look. One of the giants lays down sedate in the grass just 15 meters away. The cameras click away. God gradually brings up the group toward the gorillas, cutting away at undergrowth with his machete. The tourists move forward, crouching close to the ground, eagerly snapping photographs. But doesn't it cause gorillas harm or stress when humans visit them like this? Robbins, our gorilla expert, says her analysis of the gorilla's reproduction cycle hasn't revealed any major problems.
And we don't see any signs of, for example, like lower birth rate or anything like that. And if anything, there's some evidence suggesting that the gorillas that are habituated, because they're visited every day and because they're monitored every day, those groups actually are doing almost better than some of the unhabituated groups.
But the numbers of visitors are closely controlled. No more than 8 people may visit, and they aren't allowed to stay any longer than an hour each day.
So, let's look for the way back. Happy?
Yeah.
Good.
Last year, Robbins and her team combed the forest to gather scat. The genetic analysis is currently underway. They hope to determine how many mountain gorillas there are in Bwindi by the end of the year.
Thank you to Brigitte Osterrat for that report. The English version was read by Gabriel Borud. And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. Saroja Coelho will be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at DW_eco. For now, I'm Louisa Schaefer. Thanks for listening.